The other men lounged about, idly looking out over the wall. Guard duty, Dalinar thought, stepping up and scanning the landscape outside. This rock formation was at the end of an enormous plain, the perfect situation for a fortress. No army could approach without being seen long before its arrival. The air was cold enough that clumps of ice clung to the stone in shadowed corners. The sunlight did little to dispel the cold, and the weather explained the lack of grass. The blades would be retracted into their holes, awaiting the relief of spring weather. Dalinar pulled his cloak closer, prompting one of his companions to do the same. "Storming weather," the man muttered. "How long's it going to last? Been 8 weeks already."
8 weeks? 40 days of winter at once? That was rare.
Despite the cold, the other three soldiers looked anything but engaged by their guard duties. One was even dozing.
"Stay alert," Dalinar chided them.
They glanced at him, the one who had been dozing blinking awake. All three seemed incredulous. One, a tall red-haired man, scowled.
"This from you, Leaf?"
Dalinar bit back a retort. Who did they see him as? The chill air made his breath steam, and from behind him he could hear metal clanging as men worked at forges and anvils below. The gates to the fortress were closed, and the archer towers were manned to the left and right. They were at war, but guard duty was always boring work. It took well-trained soldiers to remain alert for hours on end. Perhaps that was why there were so many soldiers here. If the quality of eyes watching could not be assured, then quantity would serve. However, Dalinar had an advantage. The visions never showed him episodes of idle peace. They threw him into times of conflict and change, turning points. So it was that, despite dozens of other eyes watching, he was the first to spot it.
"There," he said, leaning out over the side of the rough stone crenellation. "What is that?"
The red-haired man raised a hand, shading his eyes.
"Nothing. A shadow."
"No, it's moving," said one of the others. "Looks like people. Marching."
Dalinar's heart began to thump in anticipation as the red-haired man called the alert. More archers rushed onto the battlement, stringing bows. Soldiers gathered in the ruddy courtyard below. Everything was made of that same red rock, and Dalinar caught one of the men referring to this place as Feverstone Keep. He'd never heard of it. Scouts galloped from the keep on horses. Why didn't they have outriders already?
"It has to be the rear defense force," one soldier muttered. "They can't have gotten through our lines. Not with the Radiance fighting."
"Radiance?" Dalinar stepped closer to listen, but the man gave him a scowl and turned away. Whoever Dalinar was, the others didn't much care for him. Apparently, this keep was a fallback position behind the front lines of a war. So either that approaching force was friendly, or the enemy had punched through and sent an advance element to besiege the keep. These were reserves, then, which was probably why they had been left with few horses. They still should have had outriders. When the scouts finally did gallop back to the keep, they bore white flags. Dalinar glanced at his companions, confirming his suspicions as they relaxed. White meant friends. Yet would he have been sent here if it were that simple? If it was just in his mind, why would it fabricate a simple, boring vision when it never had before?
"We need to be alert for a trap," Dalinar said. "Someone find out what those scouts saw. Did they identify banners only, or did they get a close look?"
The other soldiers, including some of the archers who now filled the wall top, gave him strange looks. Dalinar cursed softly, glancing back out at the shadowy oncoming force. He had a foreboding itch in the back of his skull. Ignoring the odd looks, he hefted his spear and ran down the walkway of the wall top, reaching a set of stairs. They were built in switchbacks, running in zigzags straight down the tall wall with no railing. He'd been on such fortifications before and knew how to keep his eyes focused on the steps to avoid vertigo. He reached the bottom and, spear resting on his shoulder, struck out to find someone in charge.
The buildings of Feverstone Keep were blocky and utilitarian, built up against one another along the rock walls of the natural rift. Most had square rain catchers on top, with good food stores, or if lucky, a soul caster. Such a fortification could withstand a siege for years. He couldn't read the rank insignias, but he could recognize an officer when he saw one standing in a blood-red cloak with a group of honor guards. He had no mail, just a shiny bronze breastplate over leather, and was conferring with one of the scouts. Dalinar hurried up. Only then did he see the man's eyes were dark brown. That gave Dalinar a shock of incredulity. Those around him treated the man like a bright lord.
"The Order of the Stone Wards, my lord," the still-mounted scout was saying. "And a large number of windrunners. All on foot."
"But why?" the dark-eyed officer demanded. "Why are Radiants coming here? They should be fighting the devils on the front lines."
"My lord," the scout said, "our orders were to return as soon as we identified them."
"Well, go back and find out why they're here," the officer bellowed, causing the scout to flinch, then turned to ride away.
The Radiants. They were usually connected to Dalinar's visions in one way or another. As the officer began to call commands to his attendants, telling them to prep empty bunkers for the knights, Dalinar followed the scout toward the wall. Men crowded near the kill slits there, peering out at the plain. Like those above, these wore motley uniforms that looked pieced together. They weren't a ragged bunch, but were obviously wearing second-hand leavings. The scout rode through a sally port as Dalinar entered the shadow of the enormous wall, walking up to the back of a crowd of soldiers.
"What is it?" he asked.
"A Radiance," one of the men said. "They've broken into a run."
"It's almost like they're going to attack," said another.
He chuckled at how ridiculous that sounded, though there was an edge of uncertainty to his voice.
"What?"
Dalinar thought, anxious.
"Let me through."
Surprisingly, the men parted. As Dalinar pushed by, he could sense their confusion. He'd given the command with the authority of a high prince and a light eyes, and they'd obeyed instinctively. Now that they saw him, they were uncertain. What was this simple guardsman doing, ordering them about? He didn't give them a chance to question him. He climbed onto the platform against the wall, where a rectangular kill slit looked through the wall and onto the plain. It was too small for a man to get through, but wide enough for archers to fire out. Through it, Dalinar saw that the approaching soldiers had formed a distinct line. Men and women in gleaming shardplate charged forward. The scout pulled to a halt, looking at the charging shardbearers. They ran shoulder to shoulder, not a single one out of place. Like a crystalline wave. As they drew closer, Dalinar could see that their plate was unpainted, but it glowed either blue or amber at the joints and across glyphs at the front, as with other radiance he'd seen in his visions.
"They don't have their shard blades out," Dalinar said. "That's a good sign."
The scout outside backed his horse up. There looked to be a good 200 shard bearers out there. Alethkar owned some 20 blades, Yakaved a similar number. If one added up all the rest in the world, there might be enough total to equal the two powerful Voren kingdoms. That meant, so far as he knew, there were less than 100 blades in all of the world. And here he saw 200 shardbearers gathered in one army. It was mind-numbing. The Radiance slowed, falling into a trot, then a walk. The soldiers around Dalinar grew still. The leading Radiance stopped in a line, immobile. Suddenly, others began to fall from the sky. They hit with the sound of rock cracking, puffs of stormlight blossoming from their figures. These all glowed blue. Soon, there were some 300 Radiance out on the field. They began summoning their blades. The weapons appeared in their hands like fog forming and condensing. It was done in silence. Their visors were down.
"If them charging without swords was a good sign," whispered one of the men beside Dalinar, "then what does this mean?"
A suspicion began to rise within Dalinar, the horror that he might know what this vision was about to show him. The scout, at last unnerved, turned his horse and galloped back to the keep, screaming for the door to be opened to him, as if a little wooden stone would be protection against hundreds of shard-bearers. A single man with plate and blade was almost an army unto himself, and that wasn't accounting for the strange powers these people had. The soldiers pulled the sally port open for the scout. Making a snap decision, Dalinar leaped down and charged to the opening. Behind, the officer Dalinar had seen earlier was clearing a path for himself to walk up to the kill slit. Dalinar reached the open door, darting through it just after the scout charged back into the courtyard. Men called after Dalinar, terrified. He ignored them, running out onto the open plain. The expansive, straight wall stretched above him like a highway up to the sun itself. The radiance were still distant, though they'd stopped within bowshot. Transfixed by the beautiful figures, Dalinar slowed, then stopped about 100 feet away. One knight stepped ahead of his companions, his brilliant cape a rich blue. His shard blade of rippling steel had intricate carvings along the center. He held it toward the keep for a moment. Then he drove it point first into the stone plain. Dalinar blinked. The shardbearer removed his helm, exposing a handsome head with blonde hair and pale skin, light as that of a man from Shinovar. He tossed the helm to the ground beside his blade. It rolled slightly as the shardbearer made fists in his gauntlets, arms at his sides. He opened his palms wide and the gauntlets fell free to the rocky ground. He turned, his shardplate falling off his body, breastplate dropping free, greaves slipping off. Underneath he wore a rumpled blue uniform. He stepped free of his boot-like sabaton and continued to walk away, shard plate and shard blade, the most precious treasures any man could own, tossed to the ground and abandoned like refuse. The others began to follow suit. Hundreds of men and women driving shard blades into the stone and then removing their plate. The sound of metal hitting stone came like rain, then like thunder. Dalinar found himself running forward. The door behind him opened and some curious soldiers left the keep. Dalinar reached the shard blades. They sprouted from the rock like glittering silver trees, a forest of weapons. They glowed softly in a way his own shard blade never had, but as he dashed among them, their light began to fade. A terrible feeling struck him, a sense of immense tragedy, of pain and betrayal. Stopping where he stood, he gasped, hand to his chest. What was happening? What was that dreadful feeling, that screaming he swore he could almost hear? The Radiance. They walked away from their discarded weapons. They all seemed individuals now, each walking alone despite the crowd. Dalinar charged after them, tripping over discarded breastplates and chunks of armor. He finally stumbled free of it all.
"Wait!"
he called. None of them turned. He could now see others in the distance, far off. A crowd of soldiers, not wearing shard plate, waiting for the Radiance to return. Who were they, and why hadn't they come forward? Dalinar caught up to the Radiance, they weren't walking very quickly, and grabbed one by the arm. The man turned. His skin was tan and his hair dark, like an Alethi. His eyes were of the deepest blue. Unnaturally blue, in fact. The irises were nearly white.
"Please," Dalinar said. "Tell me why you are doing this."
The former shardbearer pulled his arm free and continued to walk away. Dalinar cursed, then ran into the midst of the shardbearers. They were of all races and nationalities, dark skin and light, some with white Thalen eyebrows, others with the skin ripples of the Salai. They walked with eyes forward, not speaking to one another, steps slow but resolute.
"Will someone tell me why?"
Dalinar bellowed.
"This is it, isn't it? The day of recreance? The day you betrayed mankind? But why?"
None of them spoke. It was as if he didn't exist. People spoke of betrayal, of the day the Knights Radiant turned their backs on their fellow men. What were they fighting, and why had they stopped? 2 orders of knights were mentioned, Dalinar thought, but there were 10 orders. What of the other 8? Dalinar fell to his knees in the sea of solemn individuals.
Please, I must know.
Nearby, some of the keep's soldiers had reached the shard blades, but rather than chasing after the Radiance, these men were cautiously pulling the blades free. A few officers scrambled out of the keep, calling for the blades to be put down. They were soon outnumbered by men who began boiling out of the side gates and rushing toward the weapons.
They are the first, a voice said.
Dalinar looked up to see that one of the knights had stopped beside him. It was the man who looked Alethi. He looked over his shoulder at the crowd gathering around the blades. Men had begun to scream at one another, everyone scrambling to get a blade before they were all claimed.
They are the first, the Radiant said, turning to Dalinar.
Dalinar recognized the depth of that voice. It was the voice that always spoke to him in these visions.
They were the first, and they were also the last.
Is this the Day of Recreance?
Dalinar asked.
These events will go down in history, the Radiant said. They will be infamous. You will have many names for what happened here.
But why?
Dalinar asked.
Please, why did they abandon their duty?
The figure seemed to study him.
I have said that I cannot be of that much help to you. The night of sorrows will come and the true desolation. The Everstorm.
Then answer my questions, Dalinar said.
Read the book. Unite them.
The book? The Way of Kings?
The figure turned and walked from him, joining the other Radiants as they crossed the stone plain, walking toward places unknown. Dalinar looked back at the melee of soldiers rushing for blades. Many had already been claimed. There weren't enough blades for everyone, and some had begun raising theirs up, using them to fend off those who got too close. As he watched, a bellowing officer with a blade was attacked by two men behind him. The glow from within the weapons had completely vanished. The killing of that officer made others bold. Other skirmishes started, men scrambling to attack those who had blades, hoping to get one. Eyes began to burn. Screams, shouts. Death. Dalinar watched until he found himself in his quarters, tied to his chair. Renarin and Adolin watched nearby, looking tense. Dalinar blinked, listening to the rain of the passing high storm on the roof.
I've returned, he said to his sons. You may calm yourselves.
Adolin helped untie the ropes, while Renarin stood up and fetched Dalinar a cup of orange wine. Once Dalinar was free, Adolin stood back. The youth folded his arms. Renarin came back, his face pale. He looked to be having one of his episodes of weakness. Indeed, his legs were trembling. As soon as Dalinar took the cup, the youth sat down in a chair and rested his head in his hands. Dalinar sipped the sweet wine. He had seen wars in his visions before. He had seen deaths and monsters, great shells and nightmares. And yet for some reason this one disturbed him more than any. He found his own hand shaking as he raised the cup for a second sip. Adolin was still looking at him.
Am I that bad to watch? Dalinar asked.
The gibberish you speak is unnerving, father, Renarin said. Unearthly. Strange. Skewed. Like a wooden building pushed to a slant by the wind.
You thrash about, Adolin said. You nearly tipped over the chair. I had to hold it steady until you stilled. Dalinar stood up, sighing as he walked over to refill his cup.
And you still think I don't need to abdicate?
The episodes are containable, Adolin said, though he sounded disturbed. My point was never to get you to abdicate. I just didn't want you relying upon the delusions to make decisions about our house's future. So long as you accept that what you see isn't real, we can move on. No reason for you to give up your seat.
Dalinar poured the wine. He looked eastward, toward the wall, away from Adolin and Renarin.
I don't accept that what I see isn't real.
What?
Adolin said,
But I thought I convinced—
I accept that I'm no longer reliable, Dalinar said, and that there's a chance I might be going mad. I accept that something is happening to me. He turned around. When I first began seeing these visions, I believed them to be from the Almighty. You have convinced me that I may have been too hasty in my judgment. I don't know enough to trust them. I could be mad, or they could be supernatural without being of the Almighty.
How could that happen? Adolin said, frowning.
The old magic, Renarin said softly, still sitting. Dalinar nodded.
What?
Adolin said pointedly.
The old magic is a myth.
Unfortunately, it is not, Dalinar said, then took another drink of the cool wine. I know this for a fact.
Father, Renarin said, for the old magic to have affected you, you'd have had to travel to the west and seek it. Wouldn't you?
Yes, he said, ashamed. The empty place in his memories where his wife had once existed had never seemed as obvious to him as it did at that moment. He tended to ignore it, with good reason. She'd vanished completely, and it was sometimes difficult for him to remember that he had been married. These visions are not in line with what I've understood about the Night Watcher, Renarin said. Most consider her to be just some kind of powerful spren. Once you've sought her out and been given your reward and your curse, she's supposed to leave you alone. When did you seek her?
It's been many years now, Dalinar said.
Then this probably isn't due to her influence, Renarin said.
I agree, Dalinar said.
But what did you ask for?
Adolin said, frowning. My curse and boon are my own, son, Dalinar said. The specifics are not important.
But—
I agree with Renarin, Dalinar said, interrupting. This is probably not the Night Watcher.
All right, fine. But why bring it up?
Because, Adolin, Dalinar said, feeling exasperated, I don't know what is happening to me. These visions seem far too detailed to be products of my mind. But your arguments made me think. I could be wrong. Or you could be wrong, and it could be the Almighty. Or it could be something entirely different. We don't know, and that is why it is dangerous for me to be left in command.
Well, what I said still holds, Adolin said stubbornly. We can contain it.
No, we can't, Dalinar said. Just because it has come only during high storms in the past doesn't mean it couldn't expand to other times of stress. What if I was struck with an episode on the battlefield?
That was the very same reason they didn't let Renarin ride into battle.
If that happens, Adolin said, we'll deal with it. For now, we could just ignore—
Dalinar threw a hand up into the air.
Ignore? I cannot ignore something like this. The visions, the book, the things I feel, they're changing every aspect of me. How can I rule if I do not follow my conscience? If I continue as High Prince, I second-guess my every decision. Either I decide to trust myself or I step down. I cannot stomach the thought of something in between.
The room fell silent.
So what do we do? Adolin said.
We make the choice, Dalinar said. I make the choice.
Step down or keep heeding the delusions, Adolin spat. Either way, we're letting them rule us.
And you have a better option? Dalinar demanded. You've been quick to complain, Adolin, which seems a habit of yours. But I don't see you offering a legitimate alternative.
I gave you one, Adolin said. Ignore the visions and move on. I said a legitimate option.
The two stared at one another. Dalinar fought to keep his anger contained. In many ways, he and Adolin were too similar. They understood one another, and that enabled them to push in places that hurt.
Well, Renarin said, what if we proved whether or not the visions were true?
Dalinar glanced at him.
What?
You say these dreams are detailed, Renarin said, leaning forward with hands clasped in front of him.
What exactly do you see?
Dalinar hesitated, then gulped down the rest of his wine. For once he wished he had intoxicating violet instead of orange.
The visions are often of the Knights Radiant. At the end of each episode, someone, I think one of the Heralds, comes to me and commands me to unite the High Princes of Alethkar.
The room fell silent, Adolin looking disturbed, Renarin just sitting quietly.
Today I saw the Day of Recreance, Dalinar continued. The Radiants abandoned their shards and walked away. The plate and blades faded somehow when they were abandoned. It seems such an odd detail to have seen.
He looked at Adolin.
If these visions are fantasies, then I am a great deal more clever than I once thought myself.
Do you remember any specifics we could check on? Renarin asked. Names? Locations? Events that might be traced in history?
This last one was of a place called Feverstone Keep, Dalinar said.
I've never heard of it, Adolin said.
Feverstone Keep, Dalinar repeated. In my vision, there was some kind of war going on near there. The Radiants had been fighting on the front lines. They withdrew to this fortress, then abandoned their shards there.
Perhaps we could find something in history, Renarin said. Proof that either this keep existed or that the Radiants didn't do what you saw there. Then we'd know, wouldn't we? If the dreams are delusions or truth?
Dalinar found himself nodding. Proving them had never occurred to him, in part because he had assumed they were real at the start. Once he'd started questioning, he'd been more inclined to keep the nature of the visions hidden and silent. But if he knew that he was seeing real events, well, that would at least rule out the possibility of madness. It wouldn't solve everything, but it would help a great deal.
I don't know, Adolin said, more skeptical.
Father, you're talking about times before the Hierocracy. Will we be able to find anything in the histories?
There are histories from the time when the Radiants lived, Renarin said. They're not as far back as the Shadow Days, or the Heraldic Epics. We could ask Yasna. Isn't this what she does? As a Verist Italian?
Dalinar looked at Adolin.
It sounds like it's worth a try, son.
Maybe, Adolin said. But we can't take the existence of a single place as proof. You could have heard of this Feverstone Keep, and therefore included it.
Well, Renarin said, that may be true. But if what Father sees are just delusions, then certainly we'll be able to prove some parts of them untrue. It seems impossible that every detail he imagines is one that he got from a story or history. Some aspects of the delusions would have to be pure fancy.
Adolin nodded slowly.
You're right, Renarin. Yes, it's a good plan.
We need to get one of my scribes, Dalinar said, so I can dictate the vision I just had while it's fresh.
Yes, Renarin said. The more details we have, the easier it will be to prove or disprove the visions.
Dalinar grimaced, setting aside his cup and walking over to the others. He sat down.
All right. But who would we use to record the dictation?
You have a great number of clerks, Father, Renarin said.
And they're all either wife or daughter to one of my officers, Dalinar said.
How could he explain? It was painful enough for him to expose weakness to his sons. If news of what he saw got around to his officers, it could weaken morale. There might come a time to reveal these things to his men, but he would need to do so carefully. And he'd much rather know for himself whether or not he was mad before he approached others.
Yes, Adolin said, nodding, though Renarin still looked perplexed.
I understand. But, Father, we can't afford to wait for Yasna to return. It could be months yet.
Agreed, Dalinar said.
He sighed. There was another option.
Renarin, send a runner for your Aunt Navani.
Adolin glanced at Dalinar, raising an eyebrow.
It's a good idea, but I thought you didn't trust her.
I trust her to keep her word, Dalinar said, resigned.
and to keep confidence. I told her of my plans to abdicate, and she didn't tell a soul. Navani was excellent at keeping secrets, far better than the women of his court. He trusted them to an extent, but keeping a secret like this would require someone supremely exacting in their words and thoughts. That meant Navani. She would probably find a way to manipulate him using the knowledge, but at least the secret would be safe from his men.
"Go, Renarin," Dalinar said.
Renarin nodded and stood. He had apparently recovered from his fit and walked sure-footed to the door. As he left, Adolin approached Dalinar.
"Father, what will you do if we prove that I'm right, and it's just your own mind?"
"A part of me wishes for that to happen," Dalinar said, watching the door swing closed after Renarin. "I fear madness, but at least it is something normal, something that can be dealt with. I will give you the princedom, then seek help in Carbranth. But if these things are not delusions, I face another decision. Do I accept what they tell me or not? It may very well be better for Alethkar if I prove to be mad. It will be easier, at the least." Adolin considered that, his brow furrowed, his jaw tense. "And Satius? He seems to be nearing the completion of his investigation. What do we do?" It was a legitimate question. Troubles over Dalinar trusting the visions in relation to Satius had been what had drawn Dalinar and Adolin to argument in the first place.
"Unite them."
That wasn't just a command from the visions. It had been Gavilar's dream. A unified Alethkar. Had Dalinar let that dream, combined with guilt over failing his brother, drive him to construct supernatural rationalizations for seeking his brother's will? He felt uncertain. He hated feeling uncertain. "Very well," Dalinar said. "I give you leave to prepare for the worst, just in case Satius moves against us. Prepare our officers and call back the companies sent to patrol for bandits. If Satius denounces me as having tried to kill Elokar, we will lock down our war camp and go on alert. I don't intend to let him bring me in for execution." Adolin looked relieved.
"Thank you, Father."
"Hope it doesn't come to that, son," Dalinar said. "The moment Satius and I go to war in earnest, Alethkar as a nation will shatter. Ours are the two princedoms that uphold the king, and if we turn to strife, the others will either pick sides or turn to wars of their own." Adolin nodded, but Dalinar sat back, disturbed.
"I'm sorry," he thought to whatever force was sending the visions, "but I have to be wise."
In a way, this seemed like a second test to him. The visions had told him to trust Satius. Well, he would see what happened.
"And then it faded," Dalinar said. "After that, I found myself back here."
Navani raised her pen, looking thoughtful. It hadn't taken him long to talk through the vision. She'd scribed expertly, picking out details from him, knowing when to prod for more. She hadn't said a thing about the irregularity of the request, nor had she seemed amused by his desire to write down one of his delusions. She'd been businesslike and careful. She sat at his writing desk now, hair bound up in curls and crossed with four hair spikes. Her dress was red, matched by her lip paint, and her beautiful violet eyes were curious.
"Stormfather," Dalinar thought, "but she's beautiful."
"Well?" Adolin asked. He stood leaning against the door out of the chamber. Renarin had gone off to collect a high storm damage report. The lad needed practice at that sort of activity. Navani raised an eyebrow.
"What was that, Adolin?"
"What do you think, Aunt?" Adolin asked.
"I have never heard of any of these places or events," Navani said. "But I believe you weren't expecting me to know of them. Didn't you say you wished me to contact Yasna?"
"Yes," Adolin said. "But surely you have analysis."
"I reserve judgment, dear," Navani said,
standing up and folding the paper by pressing down with her safe hand, holding it in place while she creased the fold tight.
She smiled, walking by Adolin and patting him on the shoulder.
Let's see what Yasna says before we do any analyzing, shall we?
I suppose, Adolin said. He sounded dissatisfied.
I spent some time talking with that young lady of yours yesterday,
Navani noted to him.
Danlin? I think you've made a wise choice. She's got a mind in that head of hers.
Adolin perked up.
You like her? Quite a bit,
Navani said.
I also discovered that she is very fond of Avramelons. Did you know that?
I didn't, actually.
Good. I would have hated to do all that work to find you a means of pleasing her, only to discover that you already knew it. I took the liberty of purchasing a basket of the melons on my way here. You'll find them in the antechamber, watched over by a bored soldier who didn't look like he was doing anything important. If you were to visit her with them this afternoon, I think you'd find yourself very well received.
Adolin hesitated. He probably knew that Navani was deflecting him from worrying over Dalinar. However, he relaxed, then started smiling.
Well, that might make for a pleasant change, considering events lately. I thought it might,
Navani said.
I'd suggest going soon. Those melons are perfectly ripe. Besides, I wish to speak with your father.
Adolin kissed Navani fondly on the cheek.
Thank you, Mashala.
He allowed her to get away with some things that others could not. Around his favored aunt, he was much like a child again. Adolin's smile widened as he made his way out the door. Dalinar found himself smiling as well. Navani knew his son well. His smile didn't last long, however, as he realized that Adolin's passing left him alone with Navani. He stood up.
What is it you wish to ask me of? He asked.
I didn't say I wanted to ask anything of you, Dalinar, she said. I just wanted to talk. We are family, after all. We don't spend enough time together.
If you wish to speak, I shall fetch some soldiers to accompany us.
He glanced at the antechamber outside. Adolin had shut the second door at the end, closing off his view of his guards, and their view of him.
Dalinar, she said, walking up to him. That would kind of defeat the point of sending Adolin away. I was after some privacy.
He felt himself growing stiff.
You should go now.
Must I?
Yes. People will think this is inappropriate. They will talk.
You imply that something inappropriate could happen then?
Navani said, sounding almost girlishly eager.
Navani, you are my sister.
We aren't related by blood, she replied. In some kingdoms, a union between us would be mandated by tradition, once your brother died.
We aren't in other countries. This is Alethkar. There are rules.
I see, she said, strolling closer to him. And what will you do if I don't go? Will you call for help? Have me hauled away?
Navani, he said sufferingly. Please, don't do this again. I'm tired.
Excellent. That might make it easier to get what I want.
He closed his eyes.
I can't take this right now.
The vision, the confrontation with Adolin, his own uncertain emotions. He didn't know what to make of things any longer. Testing the visions was a good decision, but he couldn't shake the disorientation he felt from being unable to decide what to do next. He liked to make decisions and stick to them. He couldn't do that. It grated on him.
I thank you for your scribing and for your willingness to keep this quiet, he said, opening his eyes. But I really must ask you to leave now, Navani.
Oh, Dalinar, she said softly.
She was close enough that he could smell her perfume. Stormfather, but she was beautiful. Seeing her brought to his mind thoughts of days long past, when he'd desired her so strongly that he'd nearly grown to hate Gavilar for winning her affection.
Can't you just relax? She asked him. Just for a little while?
The rules.
Everyone else.
I cannot be everyone else,
Dalinar said, more sharply than he intended.
If I ignore our code and ethics, what am I, Navani? The other High Princes and Light Eyes deserve recrimination for what they do, and I have let them know it. If I abandon my principles, then I become something far worse than they. A hypocrite.
She froze.
Please,
he said, tense with emotion.
Just go. Do not taunt me today.
She hesitated, then walked away without a word. She would never know how much he wished her to have made one more objection. In his state, he likely would have been unable to argue further. Once the door shut, he let himself sit down in his chair, exhaling. He closed his eyes.
Almighty above, he thought. Please, just let me know what I am to do.
Fifty-three. Dunny.
He must pick it up. The fallen title. The tower, the crown, and the spear.
Dated Bevahach, 1173. 8 seconds pre-death. Subject, a prostitute. Background, unknown. A razor-edged arrow snapped into the wood next to Kaladin's face. He could feel warm blood seep from a gash on his cheek, creeping down his face, mixing with the sweat dripping from his chin.
Stay firm,
he bellowed, charging over the uneven ground, the bridge's familiar weight on his shoulders. Nearby, just ahead and to the left, Bridge 20 floundered, 4 men at the front falling to arrows, their corpses tripping up those behind. The Parshendi archers knelt on the other side of the chasm, singing calmly despite the hail of arrows from Sadius's side. Their black eyes were like shards of obsidian. No whites. Just emotionless black. In those moments, listening to men scream, cry, yell, howl, Kaladin hated the Parshendi as much as he hated Sadius and Amaram. How could they sing while they killed? The Parshendi in front of Kaladin's group pulled and aimed. Kaladin screamed at them, feeling a strange surge of strength as the arrows loosed. The shafts zipped through the air in a focused wave. 10 shafts struck the wood near Kaladin's head, their force throwing a shudder through it, chips of wood splintering free. But not a one struck flesh. Across the chasm, several of the Parshendi lowered their bows, breaking off their chanting. Their demonic faces bore looks of stupefaction.
Down!
Kaladin yelled as the bridge crew reached the chasm. The ground was rough here, covered in bulbous rock buds. Kaladin stepped on the vine from one of them, causing the plant to retract. The bridgemen heaved the bridge up and off their shoulders, then expertly stepped aside, lowering it to the ground. 16 other bridge crews lined up with them, setting their bridges down. Behind, Sadius's heavy cavalry thundered across the plateau toward them. The Parshendi drew again. Kaladin gritted his teeth, throwing his weight against one of the wooden bars on the side, helping shove the massive construction across the chasm. He hated this part. The bridgemen were so exposed. Sadius's archers kept firing, moving to a focused, disruptive attack intended to force back the Parshendi. As always, the archers didn't seem to mind if they hit bridgemen, and several of those shafts flew dangerously close to Kaladin. He continued to push, sweating, bleeding, and felt a stab of pride for Bridge 4. They were already beginning to move like warriors, light on their feet, moving erratically, making it more difficult for the archers to draw a bead on them. Would Gaz or Sadius's men notice? The bridge thumped into place, and Kaladin bellowed the retreat. Bridgemen ducked out of the way, dodging between thick-shafted black Parshendi arrows and lighter green-fletched ones from Sadius's archers. Moash and Rock hoisted themselves up onto the bridge and ran across it, leaping down beside Kaladin. Others scattered around the back of the bridge, ducking in front of the oncoming cavalry charge. Kaladin lingered, waving for his men to get out of the way. Once they were all free, he glanced back at the bridge, which bristled with arrows. Not a single man down. A miracle. He turned to run. Someone stumbled to his feet on the other side of the bridge. Dunny. The youthful bridgeman had a white and green fletched arrow sprouting from his shoulder. His eyes were wide, dazed. Kaladin cursed, running back. Before he'd taken two steps, a black hafted arrow took the youth in the other side. He fell to the deck of the bridge, blood spraying the dark wood. The charging horses did not slow. Frantic, Kaladin reached the side of the bridge, but something pulled him back. Hands on his shoulder. He stumbled, spinning to find Moash there. Kaladin snarled at him, trying to shove the man aside, but Moash, using a move Kaladin himself had taught him, yanked Kaladin sideways, tripping him. Moash threw himself down, holding Kaladin to the ground as heavy cavalry thundered across the bridge, arrows cracking against their silvery armor. Broken bits of arrow sprinkled to the ground. Kaladin struggled for a moment, but then let himself fall still. "He's dead," Moash said harshly. "There's nothing you could have done. I'm sorry." "There's nothing you could have done. There isn't ever anything I can do. Stormfather, why can't I save them?" The bridge stopped shaking, the cavalry smashing into the Parshendi and making space for the foot soldiers who clanked across next. The cavalry would retreat after the foot soldiers gained purchase, the horses too valuable to risk an extended fighting. "Yes," Kaladin thought. "Think about the tactics. Think about the battle. Don't think about Dunny." He pushed Moash off him, rising. Dunny's corpse was mangled beyond recognition. Kaladin set his jaw and turned, striding away without looking back. He brushed past the watching bridgeman and stepped up to the lip of the chasm, clasping his hands to his forearms behind his back, feet spread. It wasn't dangerous so long as he stood far down from the bridge. The Parshendi had put away bows and were falling back. The chrysalis was a towering oval stone mound on the far left side of the plateau. Kaladin wanted to watch. It helped him think like a soldier, and thinking like a soldier helped him get over the deaths of those near him. The other bridgemen tentatively approached and filled in around him, standing at parade rest. Even Shen the Parshman joined them, silently imitating the others. He'd joined every bridge run so far without complaint. He didn't refuse to march against his cousins. He didn't try to sabotage the assault. Gaz was disappointed, but Kaladin wasn't surprised. That was how Parshmen were. Except the ones on the other side of the chasm. Kaladin stared at the fighting, but had difficulty focusing on the tactics. Dunny's death tore at him too much. The lad had been a friend, one of the first to support him, one of the best of the bridgemen. Each bridgeman dead edged them closer to disaster. It would take weeks to train the men properly. They'd lose half of their number, perhaps even more, before they were anywhere near ready to fight. That wasn't good enough. "Well, you'll have to find a way to fix it," Kaladin thought. He'd made his decision and had no room for despair. Despair was a luxury. He broke parade rest and stalked away from the chasm. The other bridgemen turned to look after him, surprised. Kaladin had recently taken to watching entire battles standing like that. Sadius's soldiers had noticed. Many saw it as bridgemen behaving above their station. A few, however, seemed to respect Bridge Four for the display. He knew there were rumors about him because of the storm. These were adding to those. Bridge Four followed, and Kaladin led them across the rocky plateau. He pointedly did not look again at the broken, mangled body on the bridge. Dunny had been one of the only bridgemen to retain any hint of innocence. And now he was dead. Trampled by Sadius, struck by arrows from both sides. Ignored, forgotten, abandoned. There was nothing Kaladin could do for him. So instead, Kaladin made his way to where the members of Bridge 8 lay, exhausted, on a patch of open stone. Kaladin remembered lying like that after his first bridge runs. Now he barely felt winded. As usual, the other bridge crews had left their wounded behind as they retreated. One poor man from 8 was crawling toward the others, an arrow through his thigh. Kaladin walked up to him. He had dark brown skin and brown eyes. His thick black hair pulled back into a long braided tail. Painspren crawled around him. He looked up as Kaladin and the members of Bridge 4 loomed over him. "Hold still," Kaladin said softly, kneeling and gently turning the man to get a good look at the wounded thigh. Kaladin prodded at it, thoughtful.
Teft, we'll need a fire. Get out your tinder. Rock, you still have my needle and thread? I'll need that. Where's Lopin with the water? The members of Bridge 4 were silent. Kaladin looked up from the confused, wounded man.
Kaladin, Rock said. You know how the other bridge crews have treated us.
I don't care, Kaladin said. We don't have any money left, Dre said. Even pooling our income, we barely have enough for bandages for our own men. I don't care. If we care for the wounded of other bridge crews, Dre said, shaking a blonde head, we'll have to feed them, tend them. I'll find a way, Kaladin said.
Rock
began.
Storm you,
Kaladin said, standing and sweeping his hand over the plateau. The bodies of bridgemen lay scattered, ignored.
Look at that. Who cares for them? Not Sadius, not their fellow bridgemen. I doubt even the heralds themselves spare a thought for these. I won't stand there and watch while men die behind me. We have to be better than that. We can't look away like the light eyes, pretending we don't see. This man is one of us, just like Dunny was. The light eyes talk about honor. They spout empty claims about their nobility. Well, I've only known one man in my life who was a true man of honor. He was a surgeon who would help anyone, even those who hated him. Especially those who hated him. Well, we're going to show Gaz and Sadius and Ashal and any other sodden fool who cares to watch what he taught me. Now go to work and stop complaining.
Bridge 4 stared at him with wide, ashamed eyes, then burst into motion. Teft organized a triage unit, sending some men to search for other wounded bridgemen, and others to gather rockbud bark for a fire. Lopin and Dabbit rushed off to fetch their litter. Kaladin knelt down and felt at the wounded man's leg, checking to see how quickly the blood leaked, and determined that he wouldn't need to cauterize. He broke the shaft and wiped the wound with some conic shell mucus for numbing. Then he pulled the wood free, eliciting a grunt, and used his personal set of bandages to wrap the wound.
Hold this with your hands, Kaladin instructed, and don't walk on it. I'll check on you before we march back to camp.
How?
The man said. He didn't have even a hint of an accent. Kaladin had expected him to be Azish because of the dark skin.
How will I get back if I can't walk on the leg?
We will carry you, Kaladin said. The man looked up, obviously shocked. Tears formed in his eyes.
Thank you.
Kaladin nodded curtly, turning as Rock and Moash brought over another wounded man. Teft had a fire growing. It smelled of pungent, wet rockbud. The new man had hit his head and had a long gash in his arm. Kaladin held out a hand for his thread.
Kaladin, lad,
Teft said with a soft voice, handing him the thread and kneeling.
Now, don't mark this as complaining because it ain't. But how many men can we really carry back with us?
We've done three before, Kaladin said, lashed to the top of the bridge. I'll bet we could fit three more and carry another in the water litter.
And if we have more than seven?
If we bandage them right, some might be able to walk.
And if there are still more?
Storm at Teft, Kaladin said, beginning to sew. Then we bring the ones we can and haul the bridge back out again to fetch those we left behind. We'll bring Gaz with us if the soldiers worry that we'll run away. Teft was silent, and Kaladin steeled himself for incredulity. Instead, however, the grizzled soldier smiled. He actually seemed a little watery-eyed.
Kalek's breath. It's true. I never thought.
Kaladin frowned, looking up at Teft and holding a hand to the wound to staunch the bleeding.
What was that? Oh, nothing.
He scowled.
Get back to work. That lad needs you.
Kaladin turned back to his sewing.
You still carrying a full pouch of spheres with you like I told you?
Teft asked. I can't very well leave them behind in the barracks, but we'll need to spend them soon.
You'll do nothing of the sort, Teft said. Those spheres are luck, you hear me? Keep them with you and always keep them infused.
Kaladin sighed.
I think there's something wrong with this batch. They won't hold their stormlight. They fall done after just a few days every time.
Perhaps it's something to do with the shattered planes. It has happened to the other bridgemen, too.
Odd that, Teft said, rubbing his chin. This was a bad approach. Three bridges down, lots of bridgemen dead. Interesting how we didn't lose anyone.
We lost Dunny.
But not on the approach. You always run point, and the arrows always seem to miss us. Odd, eh?
Kaladin looked up again, frowning. What are you saying, Teft?
Nothing. Get back to that sewing. How many times do I have to tell you?
Kaladin raised an eyebrow, but turned back to his work. Teft had been acting very strange lately. Was it the stress? A lot of people were superstitious about spheres and stormlight. Rock and his team brought three more wounded, then said that was all they'd found. Bridgemen who fell often ended up like Dunny, getting trampled. Well, at least Bridge 4 wouldn't have to make a return trip to the plateau. The three had bad arrow wounds, and so Kaladin left the man with the gash on his arm to them, instructing Scar to keep pressure on the unfinished sewing job. Teft heated a dagger for cauterization. These newcomers had obviously lost a lot of blood. One probably wouldn't make it.
So much of the world is at war, he thought as he worked. The dream had highlighted what others already spoke of.
Kaladin hadn't known, growing up in remote Hearthstone, how fortunate his town had been to avoid battle. The entire world warred, and he struggled to save a few impoverished bridgemen. What good did it do? And yet he continued searing flesh, sewing, saving lives as his father had taught him. He began to understand the sense of futility he'd seen in his father's eyes on those occasional darkened nights when Liren had turned to his wine in solitude.
You're trying to make up for failing Dunny, Kaladin thought. Helping these others won't bring him back.
He lost the one he'd suspected would die, but saved the other four, and the one who'd taken a knock to the head was beginning to wake up. Kaladin sat back on his knees, weary, hands covered in blood. He washed them off with a stream of water from Lopin's water skins, then reached up, finally remembering his own wound, where the arrow had sliced his cheek. He froze. He prodded at his skin, but couldn't find the wound. He had felt blood on his cheek and chin. He'd felt the arrow slice him, hadn't he? He stood up, feeling a chill, and raised his hand to his forehead. What was happening? Someone stepped up beside him. Moash's now clean-shaven face exposed a faded scar along his chin. He studied Kaladin.
About Dunny. You were right to do what you did, Kaladin said. You probably saved my life. Thank you.
Moash nodded slowly. He turned to look at the four wounded men. Lopin and Dabit were giving them drinks of water, asking their names.
I was wrong about you, Moash said suddenly, holding out a hand to Kaladin.
Kaladin took the hand, hesitant.
Thank you. You're a fool and an instigator, but you're an honest one.
Moash chuckled to himself.
If you get us killed, it won't be on purpose. Can't say that for some I've served under. Anyway, let's get these men ready for moving.
Fifty-four. Giblet-ish. The burdens of nine become mine. Why must I carry the madness of them all? O Almighty, release me. Dated Palahases, 1173. Unknown seconds pre-death. Subject, a wealthy light eyes. Sample collected second hand. The cold night air threatened that a stretch of winter might soon be coming. Dalinor wore a long, thick uniform coat over trousers and shirt. It buttoned stiffly up the chest and to the collar, and was long in the back and on the sides, coming down to his ankles, flowing at the waist like a cloak. In earlier years it might have been worn with a takama, though Dalinar had never liked the skirt-like garments. The purpose of the uniform was not fashion or tradition, but to distinguish him easily from those who followed him. He wouldn't have nearly the problem with the other light eyes if they would at least wear their colors. He stepped onto the king's feasting island. Stands had been set up at the sides where the braziers normally stood, each one bearing one of those new fabrials that gave off heat. The stream between the islands had slowed to a trickle. Ice had stopped melting in the highlands. Attendance at the feast tonight was small, though that was mostly manifest on the four islands that were not the king's. Where there was access to Elokar and the high princes, people would attend even if the feast were held in the middle of a high storm. Dalinar walked down the central pathway, and Navani, sitting at a women's dining table, caught his eyes. She turned away, perhaps still remembering his abrupt words to her at their last meeting. Wit wasn't at his customary place insulting those who walked onto the King's Island. In fact, he wasn't to be seen at all.
Not surprising, Dalinar thought.
Wit didn't like to grow predictable. He'd spent several recent feasts on his pedestal doling out insults. Likely he felt he'd played out that tactic. All nine other High Princes were in attendance. Their treatment of Dalinar had grown stiff and cold since refusing his requests to fight together. As if they were offended by the mere offer. Lesser Light Eyes made alliances, but the High Princes were like kings themselves. Other High Princes were rivals, to be kept at arm's length. Dalinar sent a servant to fetch him food and sat down at the table. His arrival had been delayed while he took reports from the companies he'd called back, so he was one of the last to eat. Most of the others had turned to mingling. To the right, an officer's daughter was playing a serene flute melody to a group of onlookers. To the left, three women had set up sketch pads and were each drawing the same man. Women were known to challenge each other to duels in the way of men with shard blades, though they rarely used the word. These were always friendly competitions or games of talent. His food arrived, steamed stagum, a brownish tuber that grew in deep puddles, atop a bed of boiled tallow. The grain was puffed with water, and the entire meal was drenched in a thick, peppery brown gravy. He slid out his knife and sliced a disc off the end of the stagum. Using his knife to spread tallow over the top, he grasped the vegetable disc between two fingers and began to eat. It had been prepared both spicy and hot this night, probably because of the chill, and tasted good as he chewed, the steam from his plate fogging the air in front of him. So far, Yasna had not replied regarding his vision, though Navani claimed she might be able to find something on her own. She was a renowned scholar herself, though her interests had always been more in fabrials. He glanced at her. Was he a fool to offend her as he had? Would it make her use the knowledge of his visions against him? No, he thought. She wouldn't be that petty. Navani did seem to care for him, though her affection was inappropriate. The chairs around him were left empty. He was becoming a pariah, first because of his talk of the codes, then because of his attempts to get the High Princes to work with him, and finally because of Sadius's investigation. No wonder Adolin was worried. Suddenly, someone slid right into the seat beside Dalinar, wearing a black cloak against the chill. It wasn't one of the High Princes. Who would dare? The figure lowered his hood, revealing Wit's hawk-like face. All lines and peaks, with a sharp nose and jaw, delicate eyebrows, and keen eyes. Dalinar sighed, waiting for the inevitable stream of too clever quips. Wit, however, didn't speak. He inspected the crowd, his expression intense.
Yes, Dalinar thought. Adolin is right about this one, too.
Dalinar himself had judged the man too harshly in the past. He was not the fool some of his predecessors had been. Wit continued in silence, and Dalinar decided that, perhaps, the man's prank this night was to sit down beside people and unnerve them. It wasn't much of a prank, but Dalinar often missed the point of what Wit did. Perhaps it was terribly clever if one had the mind for it. Dalinar returned to his meal.
"Winds are changing," Wit whispered.
Dalinar glanced at him. Wit's eyes narrowed and he scanned the night sky.
"It's been happening for months now. A whirlwind, shifting and churning,
blowing us round and around, like a world spinning, but we can't see it because we're too much a part of it.
World spinning. What foolishness is this?
The foolishness of men who care, Dalinar, Witt said, and the brilliance of those who do not. The second depend on the first, but also exploit the first, while the first misunderstand the second, hoping that the second are more like the first. And all of their games steal our time, second by second.
Witt, Dalinar said with a sigh, I haven't the mind for this tonight. I'm sorry if I'm missing your intent, but I have no idea what you mean.
I know, Witt said, then looked directly at him. Edel Nalsium.
Dalinar frowned more deeply.
What?
Witt searched his face.
Have you ever heard the term, Dalinar?
Edo what?
Nothing,
Witt said. He seemed preoccupied, unlike his usual self.
Nonsense, balderdash, figgledigrack. Isn't it odd that gibberish words are often the sounds of other words cut up and dismembered, then stitched into something like them, yet wholly unlike them at the same time?
Dalinar frowned.
I wonder if you could do that to a man. Pull him apart, emotion by emotion, bit by bit, bloody chunk by bloody chunk. Then combine them back together into something else, like a Dicean Amian. If you do put a man together like that, Dalinar, be sure to name him Gibberish after me. Or perhaps Giblettish.
Is that your name, then? Your real name?
No, my friend, Witt said, standing up. I've abandoned my real name. But when next we meet, I'll think of a clever one for you to call me. Until then, Witt will suffice, or if you must, you may call me Hoyd. Watch yourself. Sadeus is planning a revelation at the feast tonight, though I know not what it is. Farewell. I'm sorry I didn't insult you more.
Wait, you're leaving?
I must. I hope to return. I'll do so if I'm not killed. Probably will anyway. Apologize to your nephew for me.
He won't be happy, Dalinar said. He's fond of you.
Yes, it's one of his more admirable traits, Witt said. Alongside that of paying me, letting me eat his expensive food, and giving me opportunity to make sport of his friends. The Cosmere, unfortunately, takes precedence over free food. Watch yourself, Dalinar. Life becomes dangerous, and you're at the center of it.
Witt nodded once, then ducked into the night. He put his hood up, and soon Dalinar couldn't separate him from the darkness. Dalinar turned back to his meal.
Sadeus is planning a revelation at the feast tonight, though I know not what it is.
Witt was rarely wrong, though he was almost always odd. Was he really leaving? Or would he still be in camp the next morning, laughing at the prank he had played on Dalinar?
No, Dalinar thought. That wasn't a prank.
He waved over a master servant in black and white.
Fetch my elder son for me.
The servant bowed and withdrew. Dalinar ate the rest of his food in silence, glancing occasionally at Sadeus and Alokar. They weren't at the dining table any longer, and so Sadeus's wife had joined him. Ialai was a curvaceous woman who reportedly dyed her hair. That indicated foreign blood in her family's past. Alethi hair always bred true, proportionate to how much Alethi blood you had. Foreign blood would mean stray hairs of another color. Ironically, mixed blood was far more common in light eyes than dark eyes. Dark eyes rarely married foreigners, but the Alethi houses often needed alliances or money from outside. Food finished, Dalinar stepped down from the king's table onto the island proper. The woman was still playing her melancholy song. She was quite good. A few moments later, Adolin strode onto the king's island. He hurried over to Dalinar.
Father, you sent for me?
Stay close. Witt told me that Sadeus plans to make a storm of something tonight. Adolin's expression darkened.
Time to go, then.
No, we need to play this out.
Father,
but you may prepare, Dalinar said softly. Just in case. You invited officers of our guard to the feast tonight?
Yes, Adolin said. 6 of them.
They have my further invitation to the King's Island. Pass the word. What of the King's Guard? I've made sure that some of the ones guarding the island tonight are among those most loyal to you.
Adolin nodded toward a space in the darkness to the side of the feasting basin.
I think we should position them over there. It'll make a good line of retreat in case the King tries to have you arrested.
I still don't think it will come to that.
You can't be sure. Elokar allowed this investigation in the first place, after all. He's growing more and more paranoid.
Dalinar glanced over at the King. The younger man almost always wore his shard plate these days, though he didn't have it on now. He seemed continually on edge, glancing over his shoulder, eyes darting from side to side.
Let me know when the men are in position, Dalinar said.
Adolin nodded, walking away quickly. The situation gave Dalinar little stomach for mingling. Still, standing alone and looking awkward was no better, so he made his way to where High Prince Hatham was speaking with a small group of light eyes beside the main fire pit. They nodded to Dalinar as he joined them. Regardless of the way they were treating him in general, they would never turn him away at a feast like this. That simply wasn't done to one of his rank.
Ah, Bright Lord Dalinar, Hatham said in his smooth, overly polite way.
The long-necked slender man wore a ruffled green shirt underneath a robe-like coat, with a darker green silk scarf around the neck. A faintly glowing ruby sat on each of his fingers. They'd each had some of their stormlight drained away by a fabrial made for the purpose.